May I have your attention, please? Good afternoon. I'm Alan Horton, president of the club, and it's my privilege to welcome you all to the fourth meeting of our season. We're going to have a very special speaker today who seems to find his name in the headlines quite frequently lately. Please silence your cell phones if you haven't done so already. We don't need any interruptions later. And remember that we have two more programs in January. The next one, January 23rd, Michael Farr, CNBC commentator, who will probably be a great follow-up to what we hear today. And before we proceed further, let me introduce Rabbi Edward Moline from the Jewish Congregation of Marco Island to give our invocation.
Thank you very much. Behold how good and how pleasant it is to gather together in unity for this special event. As we begin a new year with new hopes, and new visions, and new energy, to overcome the problems, the despair, and the anxiety that we experienced as a nation in the year that has passed. Our guest of honor is in the best position to share with us the pain and the anguish we experienced in the past year. He is also in the best position to share with us a vision, some perspective of how our country and the business community and the citizens of our nation may look forward with hope and promise to a more prosperous climate in the new year that has begun. In the Hebrew tradition, there is a song that comes out of modern Israel that we sing when we celebrate a new year. Its words are, O tireh, O tireh, kama tov yihyeh, Bashana haba'a haba'a. You will see what a year it can truly be. Yes, the new year that has just begun. May the new year bring peace and serenity and tranquility to the people of our nation, to the nations of the world. May it be a year of happiness and joy and contentment for all of us. In gratitude for all the blessings that have come to us in the past and those that are yet to be bestowed upon us, we offer grateful thanks. And we offer thanks for this food of which we're about to partake, as I offer the traditional words of blessing. Blessed art thou, O Lord, our God, King of the universe, who bringest forth bread from the earth. Amen.
Please go ahead and eat. And while you're eating, we have a couple of special treats today. I'd like to introduce Shelley Church, who is president chairman of our student guest committee, to introduce special guests.
Thanks, Alan. Good afternoon. How about those Gators? I had to say that. I figure I was amongst friends here. First of all, I'd like to, our students today are from Everglades City, and those of you that are not familiar with Everglades High School, it's the first high school in Collier County. It's probably the only school in the state of Florida that is K through 12. There's 147 students in the entire school and only 30 in the high school, which explains why we only have two students today, but we have two outstanding students, the valedictorian and the salutatorian. Before I introduce them to you, though, I'd like to introduce our host today. Andy DeVito with Smith Barney is hosting our students. We'd like to thank Andy. He's on our board. And I'd like to also introduce the counselor from Everglades City, Dr. Vince Doria. He actually is the counselor for K through 12, so that's got to be an interesting for all those grades. I'd like to introduce Dr. Doria and thank him for bringing the students. So we'll start. Renee, you want to go first? Okay, Renee is a valedictorian from Everglades City.
Hello, I'm Renee Gonzalez. Yes, I'm the valedictorian. Currently, I'm a senior this year, and currently I'm a dual enrollment student at Edison State College, where I've taken courses there for the past three semesters. When I graduate high school, I hope to go to Florida State University and major in business and also become an entrepreneur, because one day I want to own my own business, possibly a restaurant. So, yeah, so thank you.
Hi, I'm Carissa Brown. I'm also a senior at Everglades City School, and I'm the salutatorian of my class. I also have did dual enrollment for one semester at Edison State College. And when I graduate, my plans are to attend the University of Miami and pursue a career as a surgeon. So, thank you.
We have one more special guest. To introduce that special guest is Roy White, who is the chairman of our scholarship committee.
Thank you, Alan. Good afternoon, everybody, and I wish everyone a happy new year. I'd like to give you my attention for just a few minutes. I've been attending the Forum Club luncheons now since 1987, and that's a long time. I've often wondered during that period of time what happens to the students that we grant scholarships to. Where do they go? What do they do? Are they doctors, lawyers, businessmen, professors, or are they in jail? So today we're going to find out. We're going to hear from Kevin Crowley. Kevin was awarded a Forum Club member's Gentry Scholarship last year, and he's going to tell us where he's been, where he's going, and what he's doing presently. Kevin can speak for himself. I found that out in just a few moments that I've been with him, and I think we'll be pleased by what he tells us. We have another first today, though. I'm privileged to introduce Kevin's parents. So for seniority purposes, I'm going to ask Deidre and John Crowley to stand and be recognized. And now, Kevin, you're the man of the hour. It's your turn to tell us what you've been doing.
Thank you very much, Mr. White. Well, I'm not in jail yet, so it's great to be back here, back in Naples, Florida, and thank you very much for having me to represent some of the other scholarship winners. In about 2 days' time, I'll return back to the snow and ice of Worcester, Massachusetts, where I go to Holy Cross and dive back into my second semester. About 4 months earlier, I started at Holy Cross, a small liberal arts school in Worcester, and took a smattering of courses, still trying to figure out what it is that I want to do. Interested in engineering, interested in business, environmental science. I'm still trying to figure it out myself, so I can't tell you exactly where I'm going yet. But I'm an accounting major now, and as an Eagle Scout, my interest in the outdoors has been, I've really regained my interest as I came back up north. I love the Northeast, the snow and the ice. Some people hate it. I love it. I can't wait to go snowboarding again. So who knows where the future will bring me with that. At Holy Cross, they started a new first-year program. It's called Montserrat, based on St. Ignatius of Loyola. and it's a first-year program to introduce students to the community and get in touch with some upper-level professors. And I took a seminar called Stewardship and Sustainability, which in the green world that we're in these days is very, very pertinent. And so that's just one of the programs that's going on at Holy Cross that I've been involved with. Other than that, extracurricularly, I've gotten my own radio show on the WCHC campus in Worcester. I'm involved in this Frisbee team, SPUD, which is a student program for urban development, SPUD, and volunteered teaching kids in urban Worcester. And I'm applying to be a summer orientation leader to introduce the class of 2013 and hopefully make the transition as smooth as mine was. And as for my plans for the immediate future, this summer I'm hopefully going to intern where? I'm still trying to figure that out. I'm interested in the investment business and the radio as well, whether it be in the Northeast or, you know, in the Southeast down here in Florida. But I tell you all this because this is what the college experience is all about. And, you know, finding one's likes and dislikes and, you know, what you want to do with your life. And I wouldn't really be able to come and give this speech to you if I hadn't had a generous donation of the Forum Club itself. So I really would like to thank the Forum Club for giving me a leg up to help support the increasingly high cost of college education, especially at Holy Cross. So thank you very much to the Forum Club for having me here today, and for sponsoring me, you know, this past year. So thank you very much.
Our ladies and gentlemen, I told you that Kevin could speak for himself, and I think he just proved that. Are you impressed? I'm just going to take another moment and then leave the podium. But last year, under the leadership of Ula Norris, we awarded 32 scholarships to Collier County students. And the scholarships were awarded on the basis of need and achievement. We hope to do better this year, and we'd like to ask you all to help us. I can tell you that one of the most rewarding experiences of my life was going through the interviewing process with the students seeking our help. Their need was substantial, and their achievements were really remarkable, in many cases, in view of very adverse circumstances. You'll find yellow forms on each table. Please take one with you, take it home, or even better still, sign one here and now. We'll appreciate it, and so will the kids. Let's make a difference. Let's help make a real difference in their lives so that they can hopefully make a difference in our lives and in our world. Thank you very much.
Continue enjoying your meal, and we'll be back with the speaker in about 20 or 30 minutes. Is everybody ready? I have your attention, please. You know, the thing that makes this club so successful is we have terrific people with terrific connections. And I'd like to introduce one of those absolutely terrific people with terrific connections, Mike Armstrong, longtime member, who arranged for us to get our speaker today, and Mike will introduce the speaker. Please welcome Mike Armstrong.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. Believe it or not, it was back in mid-2007 when your laid-back president approached me that he thought it'd be a good idea to have a banker speak to the Forum Club. Back in mid-2007, the economy was growing GDP at 3.5%. The Dow Jones Industrial had just gone over 14,000 points. The finance industry, as a composite group, was growing some 16%. And Citigroup, off the back of its second quarter, just the second quarter, had net income, that's after tax for the quarter, of $6.26 billion off of a $16.6 billion revenue. 18 months later, Alan and I sit down and talk. And he says, Mike, I think it's even a better idea that we hear from a banker. Life has changed for all of us. We're in the midst of a very severe recession. The financial industry is in decline and redefinition and restructuring. Citi has taken some $40 billion of charges and has had five consecutive quarters without profitability. As one of the largest holders of nearly every class of assets, Citi is by definition in the center of these global financial activities. It was one of the first institutions to encounter the difficulties. It was one of the first institutions to take decisive action. In December of 2007, the board of Citi brought in new leadership. Vikram Pandit, our speaker today, was appointed CEO. His charge was straightforward, but quite challenging. To define and execute a strategy to create significant new value in the face of those challenges, to take personal and direct control of risk and the risk structure in the business, significantly strengthen the balance sheet, and get the costs much more competitive. In his first year, that was 2008, he has delivered notable successes. His universal bank strategy is on track, and in fact, for the first three quarters of 2008, adjusted for charges, $93 billion of revenue. 60% of his leadership team are new, and he was one of the first in December of 2007 to go out and get the capital that he knew was going to be needed, and he's raised over $75 billion of new capital to bring Citi's Tier 1 capital ratio to one of the strongest and the best in the industry, and brought cash up to $52 billion. In Vikram, the board recognized a person with a deep understanding of the financial management and risk management. He's proven to be a very outstanding leader in a very difficult environment. And he has shown grace under tremendous pressure and has maintained his steady resolve no matter what challenge has confronted him. These qualities not only make him the right man at the right time for Citi, they make him the right speaker at the right time for our forum club. I'm pleased to introduce the CEO of Citigroup, Vikram Pandit.
Mike, thank you. What an incredible introduction. Mike is my boss, so whatever he says is right, always. It's great to be down here. Thank you. Thank you for inviting me. Just so you know, it was 28 degrees in New York. It's not only the weather, I mean, it's great down here. You can imagine nowadays I try to do almost anything to get away from New York. I really want to make this interactive. I really do. I want to hear what's in your mind. I want to answer any questions that you might have. And Mike's going to collect them, and then he's going to ask me some of those questions. Great that Mike's here because he gets the difficult ones as well. What I want to do, I want to talk about 2008 and give you a banker's perspective. I want to talk about 2009. And then we can talk about beyond, if you want, as well. The starting point for all of us, let me just tell you, there is no owner's manual for anything that we're going through. We're writing it as we are going along. But the most important thing about that is when you look at the policymakers, whether it's the central bankers, whether you look at the governments here and around the world, the regulators, everybody knows that. And not only do they know it, they also know it's their responsibility to be extremely vigilant, to be very thoughtful, to be proactive, and that's been happening. That makes this a very, very different situation than most cycles that the world has gone through before. And that's something we ought to be thankful for. We really do. And when we see the new administration coming in, one of the things that is wonderful about what I'm hearing is a continuation of that vigilant approach to trying to figure out how, without an owner's manual, we get the economy to the right place. And we'll talk a little bit about that. Let me go back to 2008. Very few people early in 2008 could have really predicted what happened and how much of a change we had in the marketplace. Now, there are a few signs that were clear. The one sign that was absolutely clear very early on in 2008 and late in 2007 was that we had created incredible amount of imbalances in the world economy, particularly in the U.S. economy. And there were four key imbalances that we had to reset, and we had to rebalance the world. The first one was obvious. Housing was having a problem. Housing prices had to stabilize, so you had to rebalance the housing market to get it to a point where it starts stabilizing. The second thing that was clear is that, whether you like it or not, we as Americans consume too much. Consumption and savings were out of balance. We had to start saving. And so in addition to housing getting rebalanced, we had to recognize the consumer would have to spend less, save more. Incredible cycle that had to be rebalanced in the right way. The third was that we let our financial institutions get to a point where they had very little capital to support the lending and the loans that they made, meaning that financial institutions had to deleverage themselves dramatically here and around the world. And the last point that was clear early in 2008, it's been fixed since then pretty fast, was that there was a disconnect between where commodity prices were and where the economy was likely to go. Well, that's solved. I mean, gas is cheaper, oil is down. But the other three cycles are still with us. Those imbalances have not yet been fixed. And early on in 2008, as I had conversations with policymakers, you know, we talked a lot about we need to get from here to here. And how are we going to do it? And there were philosophical points. You know, let the markets handle it. They do it. And, you know, most of the time that's right. But any one of these imbalances would have been difficult for the market to handle. But to have all four happen at the same time created a risk of having the markets redline. And that's what's happened. There were a lot of paths to get from here to there. I can't say there were any good ones, but at least there were some okay ones. There are a lot of bad ones. And the conversations we always had with the regulators and policymakers is we need to exercise path control. How do we get from here to there to make things happen? Actually, it started working. It worked pretty well. And by the way, by July, it kind of felt like there was something good happening. We may be able to actually let the marketplace solve these issues and get to the other side. But something happened in July, and that's changed the world. Let's talk about what happened in July. First of all, the government said, you know what, Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, you are essentially nationalized. But how did it happen? These companies went out and raised billions of dollars of capital in the form of preferred stock, and a month later they were nationalized and the preferreds got wiped out. Then you had Lehman Brothers. You've all read about what happened there. The real question about what do we do about Lehman Brothers and what happened ultimately is that Lehman Brothers was let go. And a lot of people lost a lot of money doing that. People who funded Lehman Brothers, bondholders, preferred holders, stockholders, lost a lot of money. Same thing happened with AIG. A lot of people lost a lot of money. And then you had Washington Mutual. Again, bonds and equity holders in that enterprise lost a lot of money. Then you had Wachovia. You know, you had a one-step, two-step in Wachovia. We were part of one of the steps, at least. And National City and on. But think about what happened. What happened was, if you were sitting outside, and by the way, I have had these conversations with central bankers. Yes, sir. We're observing the U.S. from the outside. And there's something going on we don't like. And it's important to think about this from a foreign person's perspective, because the reality is that we have been living on foreign money for a long time. They've been funding us for the last many, many years. And they're saying, look, you know, every time a crisis comes up, you handle it differently. Okay. You did this with Bear Stearns, but then you did this with Lehman. You did this with Wachovia, and then this happened. I said, you know, is there anybody home? There's a sense of saying that, is there a theory for the case? How is this going to work out? Is there somebody trying to manage this from here to there? Now, that's important, because at that point in time, what happened is people who were funding financial institutions, Citigroup, J.P. Morgan, everybody, people who were funding financial institutions said, I've gotten too risky. And so if I had $100 to fund Citi, and so I bought Citi's bond, say, you know what, that's too much risk. Maybe it should be 50. Take it out. And all of a sudden, what you found by September, October, is the markets in totality essentially stopped funding the financial system in the U.S. That's dangerous. Because you've made all these loans, and you need funding to finance them. And the market said, we're not going to provide you with debt, some commercial paper occasionally, no capital, nothing. We're going to stop funding the financial system. And that was a major, major event. What happened as a result of that? Well, you can't let the financial institutions not fund themselves, because if they don't, they're gone. So what do? Well, central bankers step in around the world. If you can't issue commercial paper, don't worry about it. Bring it to me. I'll take it. If you can't issue debt to fund yourself, don't worry about it. Here's the FDIC guarantee. Go issue debt. If you don't have cash, bring me your securities. I'll give you cash against those securities. If you don't have capital, don't worry. Here's capital. And so the major event of 2008 was what happened post Fannie Mae, Lehman Brothers, that we went from a completely free market, open funding system to keep financial institutions going to a place where they are socially funded. Now, that's implicit in the U.S., but it's explicit elsewhere in the world. If you go to U.K., it's stronger than, don't worry about it, we got you. They own a big chunk of Royal Bank of Scotland. So the big change in 2008 was that financial institutions and the fabric of what gets money moving back and forth has had to rely on social intervention to keep the system going. Now, that's all the stuff you read about, right? TARP and this and that, everything else. That's kind of where we are. But something more significant happened. As a result of that, the credit markets froze. There's hardly any lending going on. As a result of that, companies who are doing business said, let me step back. I really don't know how bad this is going to be. I'm going to be cautious. I'm going to start cutting back. And all of a sudden, in the last quarter of the year, fourth quarter, you saw a tremendous pullback out from the entire economy, of saying, I better get ready for something that could be bad. These things are self-fulfilling. We know that. But the most fundamental thing that happened in 2008 is that we broke confidence in the markets. And we broke the psychology behind markets that work. Now, I happen to think, given kind of where we are, everybody's done exactly the right things to support the financial system, etc. But what that says is we enter into 2009 with a few things that are still with us. The imbalances haven't gone away. I mean, they've gotten better, but they're still there. The basic imbalances are still there in the economy. The deleveraging, well, maybe it's stabilized a little bit, but they're still there. And so all those imbalances are still there. There's no bottom yet in housing. So all those imbalances are still there. We're entering 2009 with those imbalances. We're entering 2009 very nicely, having exported this around the world, so the world economy is feeling the same things. We're entering 2009 with a clear sense that the credit markets are still not functioning. They've stabilized a little bit, but they're still not functioning. Lending is still not happening. And the most important thing to me is we're entering 2009 with fear winning over confidence. Now, I'm not going to depress every one of you here and leave you hanging there. But let me tell you this. There is no cost-free way of getting from here to there. And we own it collectively. We own the cost of redoing this economy, just like everybody else around the world owns the cost. And so if you are a policymaker, if you're a central bank, you're thinking about how do I do the best I can to solve those imbalances, get it from here to there, exercise path control in the cheapest possible way. That's what you're thinking about. And the reality is that one of the reasons I'm very, very optimistic about the new administration is they're thinking about the right things. Now, it's important that we do it because when you look at it, the world is doing it anyway. UK, they're there. They're already doing what it takes to get the economies back. China's doing it. India's doing it. A lot of places around the world are basically using both as economists, fiscal policy and monetary policy to say we need to get from here to there. But the reality is, where we are in 2009, we don't get out of this in the shortest period of time with the least cost unless you have dramatic policy response. That's what it's going to take. And it's going to take that response from the U.S. because we started it, and we're going to have to end it. It's going to take that response from the U.S. because we started the confidence issue in some ways. And so the big job for 2009 is going to be to create, craft, implement those policy responses that get these cycles to stabilize. I'm not saying recovery. I'm just saying stabilize. And stabilize in a way that starts restoration of confidence. Okay. This better be the year when confidence wins over fear. This has to be the year when that happens. Let me talk to you a little bit about what those policy responses need to be. There are three things I think that are really important that to get from here to there. One, you have to figure out how to stabilize the housing market. We have to do that. A lot of different ways of doing that. By the way, 5% 30-year mortgage is a good start. My guess is by the time we're done, it'll be in the fours. And the lower in the fours, the better off we are. There are lots of different ways. So a big part of policy response has to be attacking housing directly. The second part is you've got to unfreeze these credit markets. You need to start loans going. Unfortunately, I'm happy to make a lot of loans, but it's hard for us to borrow money in the market to turn around and lend. Same reason why people haven't been funding us for the last 6 months, or the financial system are still out there. So we need to unclog the credit markets. We may need some more actions to open up funding. That's the second thing. That, by the way, belongs with the Fed and the FDIC and those regulators. And the last thing is we need to recognize we're entering into a time frame with unemployment. Unemployment is not great for a lot of people, but more importantly, spending goes down, the economy starts shutting down. You got to get money out in the market to get them to spend, which means you need direct fiscal stimulus. The numbers have to be big, very, very big. And there, I've got no reason to believe that's not going to happen. And so the hope and the confidence for 2009 comes from the fact that I do believe the policymakers understand we need a fast and a bold policy response, because that's the surest way of shortening this readjustment process we're going through. And if that happens, by the way, if that happens, my best guess, our best guess, is that the economy stabilizes this year, that unemployment peaks this year. Even if it's December 31st, it'll peak this year. And confidence starts coming back. That gets me to beyond 2009. And that's tough. I mean, I'm telling you, beyond 2009 is very difficult because we're going to be in a very different world. First, we're going to be the G20, not the G8. It's a significant shift. Now, maybe we all thought it was inevitable anyway, but it's here. That's where we are. Secondly, you're going to have a lot of re-regulation around the world. A lot of different things. Possibility of thinking about what happens to trade. Are you going to have free trade? Are you not going to have free trade? All those kind of things. And most importantly, though, the question is, as I said, we've gotten to this architecture where we have been relying as financial institutions on social help and funding. How are we going to get out of it? What's on the other side? How do we get, you know, it's easy to get into it. How do you unclog it? And I say, okay, now free markets, start funding these financial. How do you do that? So there are lots of questions that still surround 2010. The most important thing, I guess, I would say, is that I think, though, as we get out of this, with the imbalances rebalanced in a better way, we're going to have a more balanced world. By definition, it's going to be more balanced. Now, we may not all like it, the way it all rebalances out, but it's going to be more steady, more stable, more balanced. But what the architecture of the financial services system, what banks are going to look like, that's all uncertain. It's completely dependent on, if you get away from the social help and funding, what do the funding markets look like on the other side? In all of that, the only thing I can say to you is being a bank that takes deposits is good. Okay, so I'm kind of happy where we are. I shouldn't be, I guess, given how much we had to take in losses, but I kind of like the strategy and the business model we have, because we're basically a bank. And a bank takes deposits and puts money to work. That's what a bank does. And that, to me, is really the stable business model for us as Citi. I'm not so sure I want to talk a lot about Citi, and I did say we want to have a lot of time for questions. Just a few things. This is a great franchise. Citi is an incredible franchise. 200 years old, started by funding World Trade. At that point, World Trade was New York-Liverpool, but started that way. 100 years ago, we were in 26 countries, Shanghai, Yokohama, Calcutta, Mexico City, Manila. We were in the emerging markets when it wasn't cool to be in the emerging markets. The entire backbone of this company is designed on funding and financing global trade and global capital flows. We're in 109 countries today. Now, that's important because when the world looks at Citi, this is America's bank. It's America's global bank. And our strength in different parts of the world is a reflection on America's financial strength. It's a tough burden to carry, but unfortunately it's true. But it's a fantastic franchise. I'm not saying everything that we did, obviously not, was right, but we don't necessarily have any strategic issues. These are financial issues. But we're cleaning up. We're cleaning up the bank. The most important thing that, and Mike's talked about, that we're doing, we are cleaning it up, simplifying it, and creating an incredible amount of operating leverage. So when the economy turns, our shareholders, and I know some of you are shareholders, will start seeing the returns as a result of that creation of operating leverage. And then we're back to some very simple principles. What differentiates us compared to every bank is that we are global. It's our globality. I don't even know if that's a word, but it's the globality. Doctor, what do you think? Is this? It's a word. Okay, thank you. It's our globality. And the fact is that we bring our clients to the world and the world to our clients. We're helping the world globalize. And that's a wonderful place to be, because that's not a cycle we're going to reverse. That's a wonderful place to be, and frankly, there's no other like this. And so we have a one-of-a-kind great future as we get through this on the other side. Let me just say a couple of things. I think one of the things that we're going to have to do, I don't know if it's 2009, 2010, is restore trust between the financial industry and its clients. That's a big thing. We've broken it. And, you know, and I'll take our share of the responsibility, but I think it's the entire industry. And we've got to get back to understanding we have a set of responsibilities. We have a set of responsibilities. One, we have to be systemically responsible. What does that mean? You know, there may be some banks out there that think, I don't need the government, I don't need the capital, I don't need the funding. My guess is that number is much smaller than it was, probably not very large, and I won't either be able to tell the difference between whether it's the truth or just bravado at that point. But the fact is we're all here because of the social intervention that had to occur. And there's a responsibility that goes with that, a systemic responsibility. Let's all work together to help the economy come out of it, whether it's dealing with mortgages, home ownership, credit cards, things of that sort. The second responsibility is to understand, by the way, and acknowledge that, you know, the financial industry, I guess, has had so much potential to help individuals realize their dreams. We got to acknowledge we dashed a lot of those hopes as being part of this. And I guess the last responsibility does come back to restoring trust. And we need to do that. And one's gone, it's difficult to restore. We all know that. It's going to take a long, it's going to be a long time. It's going to take a lot of hard work, but it really is going to involve us again going back to what the business is all about, which is helping clients and customers. So we've got a lot of work ahead of us collectively. But it's great to be here now and today with 2008 behind us. I wish it were 2010. But I feel very hopeful, and as a matter of fact, quite confident that what you're going to get around the world is a coordinated policy response, recognizing the need for the boldness required to get us to start bottoming out sometime this year. There's some good news in that. Okay. I'm going to stop there. Thank you. Mike?
Thank you. Before I turn the podium over to Mike, I want to thank Mr. Pandit for being here today and for the wonderful remarks. And, you know, we have a couple of books here, one that highlights Naples, one Marco. We welcome you at any time, and you know, speakers become members anytime they want. We have a very large wait list, but you just jumped it if you want to. I want to congratulate the members, too, because this is the largest crowd we've ever had in this room for a program here today. It's too bad we couldn't have the room across the street, because I think we would have been double this size. Now Mike has been busy trying to sort through at least 200 cards, and he left about 600 of them over there. You all have lots of questions, so Mike will ask questions.
First of all, thank you, Alan. Thank you for these books. You're just going to make it harder for me to go back. That's great. Thank you.
Well, it was not only a record turnout for Vikram today, but in about 3.5 minutes, I was trying to sort through about 100 cards, and I did my very best not to be easy on either City or Vikram, but also not to be nasty. And you were not nasty. It made my job easy to do in 3.5 minutes. So, Vikram, we're going to start. Was it not for the mark-to-market rule, would City have experienced the same degree of crisis?
No.
You want me to explain that? Give him 2 seconds.
Okay. All right. Okay. Let's go back to a bank. What do? We take deposits and make illiquid loans. The loans we make have to be illiquid because you want to buy houses and other things. I mean, we can't just go around, turn around, and sell them. So what makes banks work is an understanding that says, you know, the value of these loans may go up and down, and doesn't matter what the value is in the market of these loans, as long as you have the right funding against the loan, the only thing that matters is it money good or not? And if it's money good, then you're doing great. Don't worry about it. Somewhere along the way in the last few years, we lost what banking was all about and what the accountants, particularly the SEC, which is more experienced in trading businesses rather than banking businesses, said, you know, when that loan goes down, mark it down. Okay. And I said, wait a minute. This loan is money good. So it doesn't matter. You know, prices have changed in the market. Mark it down. So, okay. So because it's marked down, go raise more capital. Okay. Against it. So you have a fundamental issue, and it is truly a fundamental issue, and it is something that everybody's thinking about it. And my point of view is if that continues, you won't have a bank. Who's going to make illiquid loans if I know that 3 days from now if prices change and the money is really good, I may be out of business because the loan just got marked down? This is a fundamental question. In our own case, it's billions and billions of dollars of the marks that we took. Billions and billions of dollars of marks. Now, the good news, I guess, is if we live long enough, the money is going to be good, so we're going to get all of that back. I guarantee you we are going to live long enough, so we will get the money back, but in the meantime, it's causing a lot of pain. And it is one of the things that is undermining the confidence in financial institutions. It's one of the reasons why they can't get funding. It's one of the reasons why they cannot get the capital they need, et cetera. Is that a good enough explanation?
That's good enough.
Thank you. Okay.
Vikram, you mentioned that you were part of a two-step deal in a Wachovia transaction. Could you explain how Wells could come forward and do what they did?
Are you sure you didn't write those questions? Okay. How could they do it? I don't know is the answer to that. So, look, I mean, this. Let me talk a little bit about what happened with Wachovia. This is interesting. They had issues. We know that, so we don't need to go through that. And they were that close to becoming WaMu, which is the FDIC taking them over and wiping out all the debt, uninsured deposits, common stock, etc. In my view on that, is that if that had happened, you know, I hope all of you had a lot of canned goods at home, because you would have needed them. You would have had a real issue in the entire country and around the world if that had happened, which means that something had to be done for that not to happen. And, you know, we talk to the regulators all the time, and we said, you know, say, are you interested? We said, you know, we could be. I don't know. It's not necessarily needed, but we could be interested in it. So I said, okay. And I heard nothing. Then the CEO of Ecovia calls me, and, you know, calls me many times. As a matter of fact, you know, I call him back, and for some reason I was traveling. I got back home, and I was jet-lagged, so I was up at 4 o'clock. I sent him a little email and said, call anytime. Sorry I missed your call. He called me 3 minutes later. Okay? And the point was, I really want to talk to you about this. You know, would you be interested in a transaction? I said, oh, we'll look at it. Of course. Why not? We did. We looked at it. We didn't like what we saw, but we knew there was a structure that we could create by which we would do two things. One, preserve Ecovia, but also preserve us and limit the systemic risk. And we came up with that, and we gave it to him. We told the regulators, here's what it is, and call us if you need us. They said, well, that's interesting, that's nice. We're talking to somebody else. I said, go ahead. They call us on late Sunday night. And I don't know exactly when it is, because by that time I was gone. I mean, you know, it's late Sunday night. I haven't heard. Something must have happened. Late Sunday night. And I don't know whether it was 10, 11, or something like that. And said, well, you know, we kind of like what you said. So, okay. And we went back and forth. 4 o'clock in the morning, Monday morning, we said, fine, we have a deal. We signed an agreement, said we have a deal. And that's when it got announced, and that was good because the markets reacted positively. We didn't have to go open up the canned goods. You know, all those things were all good, and say, okay. And as is customary with these things, you have a signed agreement, and you give it a few days to make sure that the final agreements are all documented correctly. And we had a week to get it done, and we were on track. And as of Thursday night, we had finished it all, essentially just waiting signature on Friday morning. And then on early Friday morning, I get a call from the CEO of Ecovia saying, I'm sorry, we just sold this company to Wells Fargo. Okay, I said, well, I said, do you know we have a signed agreement? Yeah, I talked to my lawyers. Okay. So, and you know, there were... You can imagine that at least 4 out of 5 regulators in Washington were really pissed about what happened, okay, et cetera, et cetera. And what it turns out had happened was there was a tax law change that was passed in that week between when we actually agreed to when Wells Fargo came in that allowed them to use the losses they would incur on Ecovia for years, and it was a lot of value. And the same people walked away on Sunday night. Wells Fargo walked away on Sunday night, left Ecovia and the country in lurch. Okay, when we stepped in, and they decided they changed their mind because of the tax changes. And, you know, and their point was, this is an unassisted deal. Well, it's not unassisted. We're paying for it. It's our money. It's taxpayer money. That's what changed mind. That's why they came back. That's what happened. And we'll let the law courts decide what happens from here on. Okay.
Vikram, we're in the paper this morning. Some people have read that the legislation may take place that allow the bankruptcy process to influence mortgage foreclosures and restructuring and a thing called cram downs. How much will that really help? As Citi came out in support of that.
Mike, I don't know how much that's necessarily going to help or not. I do know it's the right thing to do. And just so you all know what it is, you know, we are renegotiating all the time. As a matter of fact, you know, when we sense somebody has a problem, We take their mortgage rate down to 4%. We extend the maturity down to 30 years. And by the way, if they can't make the payments, we'll take the principal down. We've been doing that. We've also been using our information to project who could get in trouble rather than who is in trouble, and say, we call on their door and say, you know what? Looks to me like you're going to have a problem. You may not know it. Why don't we start right now, et cetera? So we're doing the renegotiation anyway. The interesting thing is that if somebody goes into bankruptcy, you can't do that. All right. So it's inconceivable to me that if somebody came to you and said, I want to do this, and we would have done it anyway, because it's better to keep people in their home systemically responsible, better for us, better for them, but that for some reason, if they come to us and have been coming to us for 10 days or whatever it is, and things don't work out, they go into bankruptcy, at that point, the game's done. I said, that doesn't make any sense. So we said, we will let the judges have the option to help us renegotiate the terms so we can keep people in houses. It just seems straightforward to us, and frankly, I haven't yet figured out, amongst all the other things I need to do, why the industry had a problem with that, right? So we said, fine, this actually makes a lot of sense. And I don't know if there is necessarily a large number today, but what I do know, if unemployment gets worse from here, which it's likely to do before it gets better, then there could be more of these things. And so this is, again, looking forward to what can we do today to ensure that we anticipate any problems that might come up on this.
Vikram, we had quite a number of cards asking questions about TARP, and that is the money that has come forward from the taxpayers. And many of the questions are around, should the government have asked for an accounting of the money that in fact went to the companies under the TARP arrangement or not?
And that goes back to this concept of systemic responsibility, right? It really does in many ways. TARP money or not, whether you got a dollar of equity from TARP or whether you're just enjoying the fact you have access to the Federal Reserve Bank if you want to sell on commercial paper, if you want to, it doesn't matter what you do, we're getting access to a lot of things that don't exist in a normal free market system. So we have a responsibility. And the responsibility is to do the kind of things we've been doing with the mortgage holders, the provision you saw in the newspaper today, et cetera, all those kind of things. I think that's the bigger responsibility. In terms of the money that's gone into TARP, there are a couple of different things to keep in mind. First, banks, as I said, one of the cycles is deleveraging. People selling assets. I got too much, not enough equity. What this has done is actually stopped a lot of that, which is better for the markets. The prices don't keep going down. You start stability coming on. And the second point on that is that it does actually create capital for us to start lending, per se. And we're doing that. And other banks are doing that, too. The real question is, what should the Treasury ask or not? It's a fine line. It's a very fine line because of the fact that they want the right things to happen. On the other hand, they also want to make sure these banks are fully private down the road, and they can be financed by the public markets down the road, and they need to make sure, therefore, the banks are doing things in a way that ensures that to happen as well. And so I happen to think that the Treasury did exactly the right thing, which is by making sure that banks have capital, therefore, they can stop selling the assets, start lending, but also by doing it in a way where they're allowing banks to make those decisions correctly to start the lending going. There's always accountability, okay? And so my guess is that you could put it down in writing, or you can come back and see actually the banks did the right things. I find it hard to, I guess the way I would say it is that in hindsight, when you look back, you'll find that people use the TARP money correctly. A lot of different ways of making that happen without having it down in writing. Yeah.
Okay, two last questions that we're going to have. In terms of looking back as to what happened and the explanations that you were sharing with us, do you see that there's a need for more regulation, and in particular in the area of risk?
I think there is a need for an overhaul of the entire regulatory system. We start right there. And that's important because most of you might know this. Some financial institutions are regulated, some are not. You can actually have two identical financial institutions. One has regulations and capital requirements, the other has none. So the basic starting point is uniform regulation. Yeah, if it looks like a duck, quacks like a duck, it's a duck. That's the starting point. And so to me, the regulatory structure of the future has to recognize that financial institutions, if they're doing like activities, should be subject to the same kind of regulation and the same kind of capital requirement. That's one. The second thing that's important is financial institutions, whether they're located in New York, UK, China, should have the same capital requirements. You shouldn't have an arbitrage that I'm going to move to Shanghai because, you know, they have lower capital requirements. So that's the second thing. And the third is somehow, and it can be through risk regulation, it can be through transparency, it can be through the fact that just about everybody has to be part of some oversight group like the Fed. Somewhere there, you're going to have a supervisory linkage between large financial institutions, what I call systemically important, meaning that somebody goes, if that institution goes, is a big problem. Smaller ones don't matter, but larger institutions, they're going to have even more oversight on risk. Whether that's risk regulation or not, I don't know, but it's clearly true that the central bankers around the world are going to have to know a lot more about what financial institutions are doing. They're going to use that information a lot more proactively than they have been doing. I happen to think all of this is good. I really do think all of this is good because it creates for a more comprehensive, stable financial system, which is less likely to have the kind of ups and downs that we've been having. And frankly, I take another point of view. When things really go bad, as they have, we all collectively own the problems anyway. I said we're living on social funding. Well, if that's the case, we have the responsibility to be part of the regulatory architecture in a way that can prevent some of that to happen. So I think that's good.
I saved this question for last because there were more cards submitted on this subject. I suspect that's because some of us might have lived through some of this before. And the question is, with all of this money being put into the system, and with the new administration talking about a $1 trillion stimulus package, why aren't we going to have a year and a half to 2 years from now hyperinflation?
You know, Mike, I've been noticing those cards. They're all in the same handwriting. All the central bankers around the world are worried about that. They certainly are. But let me tell you where we are today. Where we're today is that we, as I just said, we can't get funding to go out and make more loans. We have don't have the ability to really get enough funding to go out and buy assets if they are cheap. And that's true of a lot of people who'd like to say, you know what, these houses are cheap, or these securities are cheap, I'd like to go buy them. It's very hard for people to get funding in size, which is basically a monetary problem. Somehow, somewhere, money is not going from somebody printing it to the places where it needs to go so they can start buying the stuff. If you don't solve that problem, which is one of the three policy alternatives I talked about, if you don't solve that problem, credit markets don't clear and lending doesn't start. So job number one is to make that happen. That is really important. But let's try and do it in the least problematic way as possible. So let me give you an example. The FDIC guarantee. We are getting a guarantee from the FDIC if we want to go raise three-year debt. Essentially guaranteed by the government. We go raise the money, it's ours. That's one way of doing it. The other way to have done it would have been the Fed, Federal Reserve Bank, saying to us, you want money? Here it is. Go spend it. The second one creates more money supply in the market. The first one doesn't. So they've been very thoughtful about how to get liquidity out there in the market. So liquidity is critical to get us out of the scenario we're in. If we don't get out of the scenario we're in, you can't have the high-class problem you talked about called hyperinflation. So that's the first goal. The other side of that, though, you can be rest assured that the world is very cognizant of the fact that you need to start making sure that you have path control on that, too. Take the money supply out in the right way on the backhand side as you get out of this. And by the way, the yield curve is reflecting that. The yield curve is reflecting liquidity coming in and then tightening at the back end. That's most likely what's going to happen. Any time you have the kind of money you're putting in the system, you worry about inflation. But in this particular case, I think if the market is right, what they are betting on or what they're saying is that it's going to be used as a tool to get us out of where it is, but it's not going to continue to be there in the market on the other side because the Fed will come up and clean it up on the other side.
Okay. That wraps up this afternoon.
All right.
Thank you very much.
Remember to leave your name tags at the door. Name tags at the door, please.